you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zimmer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by one of our commissioned lay ministers, Christy Anderson, Justin Chekai, who's serving as our worship associate today, our music director, Hal Walker, and a host of wonderful musicians who have prepared beautiful music for you.
The sea rises, the light fails. Lovers cling to each other, and children cling to us. The moment we cease to hold each other, the moment we break faith with one another, the sea engulfs us, and the light goes out. We light our chalice this morning with these words from the great novelist James Baldwin. May the light of our chalice point us once again to the critical work of keeping the flame of faith alive.
With thanksgiving, we are a living sanctuary anew. Let's sing together.
Make me aware we are sanctuary.
I'm a person who rarely takes things for granted, and I strive to always keep an optimistic outlook. I appreciate each and every day. I spend every possible moment with my family, and I've learned to see the beauty in a cloudy day. However, all of this has been challenged in the last 3 months as I've navigated my way through some of life's twists and turns. During these struggles, I became a different person. I lost my way. I was absolutely unable to see the good in each day because I had become consumed by the darkness. My wife, Jacqueline, tried her best to get me through this period. She told me, find your fight, you must have hope. She then reminded me of a story which we both experienced with our son, William. Prior to his birth, there were a lot of tests, a lot of insinuations by doctors that maybe he was too small or not developing properly. And we could never really get a straight answer, so we spent months in a state of unease. By the grace of the universe, William came out a healthy young boy, just a little bit lighter than most. Jacqueline told me that little boy taught me all I ever needed to know about hope. In that moment, I realized that what I was missing was hope. I had given up. Her point of view taught me that we can rediscover the blessings in life and also in the wisdom of others. Find your fight. You must have hope, she said. Since this time, I've been actively seeking out hopeful wisdom from people that I know. Many of their stories have Many of their stories have helped me through these past few weeks because I learned that in their struggles and suffering, they still managed to find hope. Now, it may not have been easy, and their hope may have been tested and potentially lost, but it always found its way back. Most of the time, and it became a common denominator in my discussions, it came back by way of the blessings in their life, however large or small they may be. I found a passage on the internet and on an internet forum that resonated with me. It was written by a young girl who was battling extreme hardships and losing hope. She stated that she was being consumed with the question, why me? Especially during her darkest hours. But upon reflection and by seeking the wisdom of others, she realized that to ask that question during the hard times was unacceptable unless she was prepared to ask the same question for all the blessings and good times in her life. May the strength and wisdom of those around us and the blessings of our lives give us the hope that we need to shine in the darkest of hours. Come, let us worship together.
I have a true story to tell you today, and you're a part of the story if you want to be. And if you are small and can't see this screen, you might wish to. So you could come up. There's a little room in the front if you wanted to come up to see the screen. Or if you have an adult whose lap you can sit on, you can do that too, whatever you prefer. Because I want you to be able to see these pictures in a moment. Come on up. There's room up here in the front row if you want to be closer. So you can see the screen when I show you some pictures in a minute. Because I think you want to sit right here so you can see the television screen right here in the front row. There you go. Because I'm really hoping that you are going to be a part of this story that I have to tell you today. This story just started happening in the last few days since the election happened in our country. And so many people have been dismayed by the results because the person who's been elected as our president doesn't share all of the values that we share. And that has been scary for people and sad for people, and people have been trying to figure out, what can I do to say what my values are in the world? They've been asking that. And someone had an idea. Their idea was to write love notes in their neighborhoods with chalk. So they took their chalk one day this week and they went out in their neighborhood, and on the sidewalk in front of their house, they wrote love notes to their neighbors. And they told about that on the internet, and somebody found out about it and they thought, that's a great idea. So they told someone else, who told someone else, who told someone else. And as of yesterday, over 1,500 people and churches have said, that's such a great idea, we're going to do that too. And that, we, includes us. Colleen and Lily are going to help pass out this chalk to anybody who wants to be a part of this. Hang on one second, Paxton. Anybody who wants to be a part of this. So if you, not just the kids, and the kids can help too, but if you think you can write a love note of peace somewhere in your neighborhood or in a park or in a public place in front of a grocery store or on a bridge or anywhere, if your body will cooperate with getting down on the ground and you would like some chalk, raise your hand and we will pass this out to you. And I hope that you will go out and write neighborhood love notes for all of our neighbors. And there are also some paper in there to give you ideas of messages you can write and a hashtag so you can post it on the internet after so everybody can see it. And by the way, if you have time after church today, this is a public place, our sidewalk. Love to see messages of love on the sidewalk in front of the church if you want to go help some of the kids after the service. To lead us into a time of silence, meditation, and prayer, I chose words from Maya Angelou, who said, "You should be angry. You must not be bitter. Bitterness is like cancer. It eats upon the host. It doesn't do anything to the object of its displeasure. So use your anger. You write it, you paint it, you dance it, you march it, you vote it, you do everything about it, you talk it. You never stop talking it." We had a service here this week on Wednesday evening, during which I invited people to write on these slips of paper, which are cut like stones, the burdens, the fears, the cares, concerns that weigh on their heart in the wake of the election. And I want to bring some of these cares and concerns and grief into our service this morning. Comfort those of us who are afraid, in danger, facing injustice and inequality, lack of security, and lack of access to health care. Comfort those of us feeling a loss of balance. Comfort those of us afraid of the hate. We need to be part of a community of love. Comfort those of us who feel empty and broken. Comfort those of us who are angry and grieving and distrusting and alienated. Comfort us in the wake of broken relationships and in our shock and dismay and disappointment. Comfort us in our loss of hope. Comfort us whose hearts are heavy with unknown depths of hatred revealed to us now. Comfort us who are worried we will never feel safe again and worried we won't be able to keep our children safe. Comfort us who are afraid for our country and for our world. Comfort us who feel for our children. Comfort us who are paralyzed. Oh, love that will not let us go. Comfort us. O love beyond our understanding, comfort us. Comfort us and help us to trust you. Comfort us and help us to remember you. Comfort us and help us to be you. Help us to be the hands and the hearts and the bodies of love. Amen.
My refuge, my haven in the storm. Will you keep the embers warm when my fire's all but gone? Will you remember? Bring me sprigs of rosemary, be my sanctuary till I can carry on. Carry on, carry on. Well, this one knocked me to the ground. This one dropped me to my knees. I should have seen it coming, but it surprised me. Will you be my refuge? My haven in the storm, will you keep the embers warm when my fire's all but gone? Will you remember? Bring me springs of rosemary, be my sanctuary, till I can carry on, carry on, carry on. In our state of true believers, on streets call us and them. It's gonna take some time till the world feels safe again. Will you be my refuge, my haven in the storm? Will you keep the embers warm when my fire's all but gone? Will you remember? Bring me springs of rosemary, be my sanctuary, till I can carry on, carry on, carry on. You can rest here in this chapel, or in a circle of friends, or a quiet grove of trees, or between two bookends. Will you be my refuge, my haven in the storm? Will you keep the embers warm when my fire's all but gone? Will you remember? Bring me sprigs of rosemary, my sanctuary, till I can carry on, carry on, carry on.
As you recall, this month's worship theme is story. Scientific studies have identified a physiological reaction that confirms the powerful impact of storytelling in building connections between listener and speaker. Brain research conducted by neuroeconomics pioneer Paul Zak discovered that stories elicit powerful empathetic response by triggering the release of oxytocin, known as the trust hormone. This brain chemical promotes connections and empathy and builds trust with the source that triggers it. Zak explains, stories are powerful because they transport us into other people's worlds. But in doing that, they change the way our brains work and potentially even change our brain chemistry. And that's what it means to be a social creature. Stories attain their power by evoking emotion that builds trust and intimacy. Episcopal minister and author David Zoll makes an interesting observation about the differing impacts of presenting facts versus evoking emotions. He explains, quote, "Research consistently shows that the more deeply we are cast under a story's spell, the more potent its influence. In fact, fiction seems to be more effective at changing beliefs than nonfiction, which is designed to persuade through argument and evidence. Studies show that when we read nonfiction, we read with our shields up. We're critical and skeptical, but when we are absorbed in a story, we drop our intellectual guard. We're moved emotionally, and this seems to make us open to seeing each other and life anew." The experiences of the following Unitarian Universalist author demonstrates the power of conveying stories relative to facts. Frances Moore LePay was a community organizer immersed in the lives of low-income Americans in the late 1960s when she began to recognize the chronic problem of hunger. When she extensively researched world hunger and food production, She came to the realization that the problem is not one of food shortage, but rather it's due to human activities driven by economics. As a result, in 1971, she wrote a book titled Diet for a Small Planet, stating that food scarcity is a myth and that shortages are created by market factors. Moore LePay thought that she had discovered an astounding revelation that, once realized, would end global hunger. 30 years later, in an interview with author Studs Terkel, Moore LePay admits, quote, "I did have the hope that if people just had the facts, that would be enough to motivate them. If they realized that you couldn't blame nature, that we were creating the misery, and it was all unnecessary, we could reorient the world system. And people would start to question our whole economic process." Of course, that didn't happen. End quote. In 1990, Moore LePay co-founded an organization called the Center for Living Democracy. The founders began a national news service to highlight stories that mainstream media chose to overlook. Stories of people around the world creatively solving their own social problems. She traveled to 5 continents to collect stories of people solving public problems and compiled them into a book of human success stories. She notes, "We human beings are social creatures and learn from one another. We all live by stories. The person in that story could be you or me." From her years of travel to developing countries, Moore LePay has come to a new understanding of the word hope. She explains that the existence of hope is not assessed by tallying evidence of the ups and downs of cultures. She says, "Hope is an act. Hope is an action. Hope is not something we find. Hope is something we become. The people we met on our journey are the most hopeful people in the world. It's not because they say, 'Oh yes, we're certain that we're winning this struggle.' But simply by their actions every day in defying all the odds against them, they experience hope. They embody it. They don't seek it. They are it. Hope is for the strong-hearted who can recognize how bad things are and yet not be deterred, not be paralyzed." Moore LePay continues, "One of the metaphors I use a lot is the drop in the bucket. We're just a drop in the bucket, and that's meaningless. But I say, no, wait a minute. If you have a bucket, those raindrops fill it up very fast. Being a drop in the bucket is magnificent. The problem is, we cannot see the bucket. Our work is helping to see that there is a bucket. There are all these people all over the world who are recreating this bucket of hope. And so our drops are incredibly significant." Moore LePay has learned that making the buckets of hope visible and meaningful requires revealing the face of humanity through stories that touch our hearts before they are judged by our minds. Today, we are in desperate need of buckets of hope. During this election season, I've devoted too much of my reading to news articles and essays written to frighten us with worst-case scenarios about the future. I have allowed myself to be overwhelmed by fear, a fear so deep that to protect my vulnerability, I've fantasized about disengagement, walking away from social problems that cry out for dire attention. I have to remind myself that we must not give in to fear. If we do, then we, like others, have fallen victim to the dishonest perpetrators who are promoting fear. From now on, with thoughtful deliberation, I will choose to read more articles that focus on uplifting stories. Instances of human triumphs are evidenced every day. The attributes of this country's marginalized people defy stereotypes. If we want to encourage greater tolerance of diverse populations, we can, of course, continue trying to influence others by using facts and rational arguments. But perhaps for more powerful persuasion, we can lift up true human stories of perseverance, achievement, and the surmounting of obstacles. In the coming weeks, as we assess how we are going to move forward, one simple and self-nurturing activity we can undertake is to go online to uncover and share stories of marginalized individuals who've achieved success despite great odds. Today, we invite you to open your hearts to true stories of inspiration and hope.
I sing of a new American. I am the child of kings and serfs, freemen and slaves, progeny of all colors, all cultures, all systems, all beliefs. I have been enslaved, yet my spirit is unbound. I have been cast aside, but I sparkle in the darkness. I have been slain, but live on the river of history. I seek no conquest, no wealth, no power, no revenge. I seek only discovery of the illimitable heights and depths of my own being. The poem I just read comes from Pauline Murray, also referred to as Pauly, who overcame huge barriers to discover the unlimited heights and depths of her own being, and in the process left a legacy of expanded opportunities for her fellow African-American women. Pauly, orphaned at a young age, was raised by relatives of modest means. As a young, idealistic student, Pauly dreamed of attending the nearby University of North Carolina University to study social work. In 1938, she was denied admission because of her race and gender. President Franklin Roosevelt had spoken at the university weeks before about equality for Americans. Pauly fired off a letter to the president, reminding him of his pledge and asking for a letter of recommendation, as she was not ready to simply walk away from the denial of admission. She received her request letter from Eleanor Roosevelt, and by now, Pauly was angry about the discrimination she had experienced. Once accepted to the university, she turned it down and instead enrolled in Berkeley's Law School. Ultimately, through fighting every step of the way as a law student, disenfranchised by her gender, Pauly earned a degree, not only a law degree, but also a PhD from Yale. During these formative years, Pauly wrote essays about what she had termed as the hurtful practices of Jane Crow, the sister to Jim Crow. And Jim Crow is a reference to the racist laws and measures that discriminated against African Americans. In 1940, Pauly was arrested in prison in Virginia for refusing to move to the back of the bus. Now, this was 15 years before Rosa Parks' similar protest sparked a bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama. Spurred by this and other instances of discrimination, Pauly joined the civil rights movement. However, she was quickly offended by the male leadership that refused to allow women to participate in giving public speeches. Rather than walk away from the overwhelming male domination, she added the fight for women's rights to her causes. Pauly wrote legal essays urging the application of gender as a protected class under the 14th Amendment, which was then being applied to the rights of racial minorities, being applied to the rights of just racial minorities. Her arguments marked the first time that the Equal Protection Clause was applied to sex discrimination. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg found Murray's prior arguments so important to her own that she included Murray as an honorary co-author on a later milestone brief. According to the Supreme Court Justice, Justice Marshall Thurgood, Pauli's trailblazing writings became the foundation for the infamous Brown versus the Board of Education court ruling. Marshall later referenced a book that she had wrote as the Bible for civil rights lawyers. In 1966, Pauli co-founded NOW, the National Organization of Women. Although the group was viewed as radical, it was not as progressive as Pauli had hoped, and so she helped found a political party of black women called the Feminist Party, which nominated Shirley Chisholm as the first woman presidential candidate. Thank you. Wanting to raise awareness for the younger generation, Pauli became a university professor and vice president, enabling her to found the first college courses on African American studies and women's studies. At the age of 64, Pauli pursued her calling to become an Episcopal priest. Although accepted into the seminary, the Episcopal hierarchy had never formally agreed to accept women as priests. Of course, that didn't deter the spirited Pauli, who through her seminary education, she fought for the ordination of women. The denomination voted to allow women priests beginning January 1st, 1979, and 8 years later, Pauli was the first group of women to be ordained as priests. Her first worship service was celebrated in the church where her grandparents had worshiped as slaves. Pauli served as Episcopal minister through age 75. She later said, "Whenever future ministry I might have as a priest, it was given to me that day to be a symbol of healing. All the strands of my life had come together. Descendant of slave and slave owner, I had already become a poet, a lawyer, a teacher, and a friend. Now I was empowered to minister the sacrament of one in whom there is no north or south, no black or white, no male or female. Only the spirit of love and reconciliation drawing us toward the goal of human wholeness." Why isn't this accomplished woman's name known today? Writer Brittany Cooper, professor at Rutgers, claims, The civil rights struggle demanded respectable performances of black manhood and womanhood, particularly from its heroes and heroines, and respectably meant being educated, heterosexual, married, and Christian. Murray's open lesbian relationships and her gender nonconformity identity disrupted the dictates of respectability, making it easier to erase her 5 decades of important intellectual and political contributions from the broader narrative of civil rights. Pauli was the ultimate mid-20th century American minority, a woman, an African-American, a lesbian who dressed in masculine attire, with the additional stigma of having belonged to the Socialist Labor Organization. Despite these barriers, or rather because of them, Pauli Murray persevered and contributed richly to the expansion of rights of the marginalized in America. And so I'll leave you with one more of Pauli Murray's poems. Dark Testament, verse 8. Hope is a word in a tuneless ditty, a word whispered with the wind, a dream of 40 acres and a mule, a cabin of one's own and a moment to rest, a name and place for one's children and children's children at last. Hope is a song in a weary throat. Give me a song of hope and a world where I can sing it. Give me a song of faith and a people to believe in it. Give me a song of kindliness and a country where I can live it. Give me a song of hope and love and a brown girl's heart to hear it.
So there's a tidal wave of hate rolling across our country, and I'm not exaggerating, you know. And I'm not going to share all the terrible details with you, because if you haven't already read the firsthand accounts for yourself, it's easy enough to do. Suffice it to say that in the last few days, countless immigrants, people of color, Muslims, women, GLBTQ people have been the victims of hate speech, harassment, intimidation, and assault. Many, many instances a tidal wave of hate. It's disgusting and terrifying, and we need to face that racism, sexism, xenophobia, homophobia, transphobia, ableism, and other forms of bias are alive and well in our nation. We have a lot of work to do, and it will not be fast, and it will not be easy. And I'm not saying anything you don't already know. So we need to prepare ourselves for the long haul. First things first, and this is what I want to say to you, dear people. Take care of yourselves. Grieve however you need to grieve, and find ways to nurture your body, mind, and spirit. Be good to yourself, and be good to each other, because chances are good that many of the people who are beloved to you are grieving too. So let us try to be gentle with each other, and patient and kind. And then when you're ready to reach out beyond your circle, do anything you can to counteract hate with love. Chalk sidewalks with love notes, smile at a stranger, say something to someone waiting in line with you somewhere. Buy something to donate to Kent Social Services for their Thanksgiving and Christmas distributions. Do any little thing you can think of to make the world a little bit more kind. And then, when you're feeling more centered in yourself, start thinking about the ways that you can be in solidarity with those who are most vulnerable. The good news of this week is that a wave of solidarity has also begun to rise up. Many people went to interfaith vigils this week to pray with neighbors of their many different faith traditions. Some students spoke up when their friends were harassed at school, and school officials took it seriously. In one incident in our own town, a student was suspended for 2 weeks for yelling racist epithets at another classmate in our high school. People in a position to influence the culture in their workplace have set a higher standard than the one modeled by our president-elect. One little tiny story from my sister-in-law. She works in a ski lodge in Colorado, which is owned and mostly run by white men. And they had a new hire orientation yesterday. She posted on Facebook last night that normally in these new hire orientations, the HR director flashes the non-discrimination slide on the PowerPoint and moves on. But yesterday, he was moved to read it word for word in its entirety. And when he was done, he said to the people assembled, "This is not a political statement. We just believe in doing what's right." And here's the thing, you all have influence. Every single one of you has a circle of influence. Whether you're an HR director or a manager or an employee in a workplace, whether you're a teacher or a professor or a student in a school, whether you raise kids or have kids in your family or belong to a family or live in a neighborhood, you have a circle of influence. So use your influence to bring your values into everyday encounters. This isn't comfortable, but we know that the emotional and physical safety of those who are marginalized is more important than our comfort. So take risks to share your values in your sphere of influence in whatever ways you can to be in solidarity. There's a lot of work to do, and it will not be fast, and it will not be easy. So I hope that you will help one another learn skills that you can use to build your capacity to be in solidarity and deepen your commitment to be part of the resistance for the long haul. The Unitarian Universalist Association has lots of resources to help you learn and grow in these ways. And this is important work you can do as a congregation. In the meantime, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. If you're not fully equipped but entirely willing, I encourage you to start wearing a safety pin on all your clothes. Put it on all your jackets and your clothes. We have some here for you. And a little card about what it means if you haven't yet seen this. In various religious traditions and people of no religious tradition, just in the last few days have started wearing these, inspired by a similar movement in Britain, where it began there as a way for people to signify that they would not tolerate anti-immigrant bias and discrimination. And in our country, this is a signal that you will not tolerate bias against people who are marginalized because of their identity. So I'm not going to pass these out because you might not be ready to wear them yet, but I'm going to put them up here. And if after the service you're ready, come get one and get a little slip of paper that tells you exactly what it means when you wear one to say that you're a safe person. If you're not ready, it's okay. There are a lot of different reasons people can be ready. You might be too raw, you might be grieving, you might not be equipped for whatever reason. That's okay. Take your time. But when you're ready, maybe you can get equipped so you can wear one too. And if you are ready, I hope that you'll wear one and then you'll be ready to respond. And I hope that you will use the congregation's resources to learn more. We have at least four people I can think of off the top of my head who could offer a training one of these upcoming Sundays after church for 30 to 45 minutes about de-escalation strategies. We have people in our congregation who have those skills, and if you're going to wear one of these pins, you might need to know how to de-escalate when you see bias happening in public, when you see people at risk. So if you're ready, wear a safety pin. If you're not, find something else you can do to be kind and to spread love. And to all of you, I offer you this blessing. May you be safe, may you be strong, may you be courageous, and may you know that you're not alone. Amen. Once each month, we take a special collection for an organization whose work we want to support. And all of our undesignated offering this morning will go to the American Civil Liberties Union, because they will be a critical organization doing the work that will need to be done in the next 4 years. If you're not already a member, consider becoming a member.
God knows what is hiding in those weak and drunken hearts. Guess he kissed the girls and made them cry, those hard-faced queens of misadventure. God knows what is hiding in those weak and sunken eyes. Fiery throngs of muted angels, giving love but getting nothing back. Oh, people, help the people. And if you're homesick, give me your hand and I'll hold it. People, help the people. Nothing will drag you down. Oh, and if I had a brain, oh, and if I had a brain, I'd be cold as a stone and rich as the fool that turned all those good hearts away.
Our closing words are from Lord of the Rings, An Epic Quest for Justice. I can't do this, Sam.
I know, It's all wrong. By rights, we shouldn't even be here, but we are. It's like the great stories, Mr. Frodo. The ones that really mattered, full of darkness and danger they were. And sometimes you didn't want to know the end, because how could the end be happy? How could the world go back to the way it was when so much bad had happened? But in the end, it's only a passing thing, this shadow. Even the darkness must pass. A new day will come, and when the sun shines, it will shine out the clearer. Those were the stories that stayed with you. That meant something, even when you were too small to understand why. But I think, Mr. Frodo, I do understand. I know now. Folk in these stories had lots of chances of turning back, only they didn't. Because they were holding on to something.
What are we holding on to, Sam?
That there's some good in this world, Mr. Frodo, and that's worth fighting for.